Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. First thing I want to talk about today is a little article that came up about proton pump inhibitors. The host of our last program mentioned that he'd been on Nexium for a long time. That's a proton pump inhibitor, and it's used for problems with heartburn. And this researcher looked at long-term exposure to proton pump inhibitors, and he found that it actually led to accelerated biological aging. Well, you can be sure that got my attention. It turns out that long-term exposure impairs acid production. Well, that's what you'd expect for an acid blocker, right? But this is acid production in the lysozyme. The lysozyme is the digestive apparatus that actually breaks down waste products in the cell. So if you don't have the ability to break down waste products, then you might not be able to get rid of trash. And if the trash builds up in the cell, it leads to premature cell death. In fact, many cellular researchers think that aging is largely due to the accumulation of old protein debris in the cells. And eventually, as we age, this junk that's sitting in the cells impairs the cellular processes to the point that the cells cease to function. At that point, the mitochondria pull the trigger on something called apoptosis, and, well, that cell just rolls up the sidewalk and heads on to the big cellular graveyard. But we don't want our brain cells going off to the big cellular graveyard any faster than the rest of us. And so two of the big diseases that we are working so hard on right now in medicine, Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's, can both be thought of as problems with cellular debris accumulating. In the case of Alzheimer's, that's a cellular debris protein called beta amyloid. And in the case of Parkinson's, alpha-synuclein. Anyway, proton pump inhibitors have been around for a long time, and they've been generalized and I think are too widely used. Really, what you should do with something like Nexium or Prilosec or Omeprazole, any of the AZOL drugs, is you should take them for a few weeks and then move to proton pump inhibitor, away from proton pump inhibitors to H2 blockers like Tagamet or Zantac if you need something for long term. But really, just like what we were talking about with the functional medicine earlier on the Think Local show, what you really need to do is look at your own behaviors. Like the host of Think Local, are you eating late at night? Are you having a lot of stress? Are you maybe drinking too much or smoking too much? Are you eating the wrong foods? Are you not bothering to chew, just wolfing down your meals? All of these things are going to contribute to that heartburn. And yeah, sure, you could put a patch on it, but you could also kind of cut it, go back to the roots and dig it out. A bit like chopping the head off of a dandelion in your garden versus pulling out the taproot and getting rid of the weed. Well, in functional medicine, we go after the root rather than just chopping off the head with a drug, which is then, of course, going to need to be given the next day and the next day. And maybe after a year, we might have to double the dose because you're starting to become resistant to it. Not the best way to address your health. Here's a short one that I think we could all stand to use. Even a minute of intense exercise has substantial benefit. This was a study where they took a group of 27 sedentary men in otherwise good health, and they performed 3 weekly sessions of exercise, or they remained sedentary. Those were the three groups. One group did a sprint interval training protocol, which involved basically 10 minutes of warming up And then on a bicycle, for 2 minutes, they just pedal along. And then for 20 seconds, they would push as hard as they could. Just 20 seconds, but they really went all out. And then they'd push, then they'd, you know, kick back and pedal for another 2 minutes and then do another 20-second sprint. And they did that four times. And then they cooled down. So the, overall, the whole thing took about 10 minutes. And then they tested fitness in that group compared to the moderate exercise group. They spent 45 minutes sitting on that exercise bike, pedaling at a moderate pace. So the 10 minutes with the three 20-second all-out sprints was just as good as 45 minutes of moderate cycling. And I can testify to this myself. I live on a hill. And a few months ago, I decided, well, I'll do this for 10 minutes. I'll do a slow jog down the hill, and then I'll sprint halfway up the hill, and then drop into a slow jog the rest of the way. And my friends, the effects on my fitness and my strength, my energy and my sleep have been amazing. So this very, very short interval, 20 seconds, three times, in other words, one minute out of that 10, really pushing as hard as you can, is huge. It just turns on the DNA in your body. You start making more muscle, you start making different muscle, and a whole lot of good things happen as a result. I want to take a moment and just talk about how that happened, what I was just talking about. How does a behavior change make its way into your body and move to the cell and result in a protein being made? And what exactly is that process? Let's have a little science lesson. So I'm going to start with that behavior. When I pushed like that, I created lactic acid in my muscles. I created a series, not just lactic acids, but other chemical signals. And those chemical signals act like hormones. They went to the nucleus of my muscle cells, and it triggered something very interesting. It triggered the beginning of a chain of RNA being made. So you know about DNA, that double-stranded spiral stuff that's curled up that 23andMe analyzes and that everybody is so excited about, the thing that makes up genes. Well, think about that double spiral as being two strands of the same information, like a positive and a negative imprint. And what we're going to do is we're going to pull those two strands apart, a bit like pulling apart a zipper. And we're going to construct a half zipper off of the pattern of one of those sides of the zipper. We're going to start at a point that's designated by the start codon, and we're going to read every single nucleotide on there, which is a type of sugar molecule, and each one of those, an A, a C, a T, or a G, is going to be translated onto this RNA. And then the RNA, this string of a half zipper worth of information, leaves the nucleus and it goes out to the cytoplasm, where it's called messenger RNA because it carries a message. Now, I'm simplifying the process for the moment because I want to really get to the protein for this discussion. So that zippered message, that half zipper of information, is code. And every three prongs on the zipper stands for a code, is a codon, and it's code for a particular amino acid. So let's talk about amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. And you can think of them like a bead. We're going to build a string of beads here because that's how we're going to think about our protein. But unlike the beads that you might buy at the store, these beads have little embedded charges on them. So think about if you had magnets, both the positive and the negative poles of magnet, and we're going to make some beads, and I'm going to make one bead, one amino acid, that has two positive charges on one side and a negative charge on the other. And I can put my little magnets in, two positives on one side, one negative on the other side. And that's going to be AAC for the amino acid. Let's call that arginine. And now, and by the way, I don't know the codon for arginine, so I'm that part of the correspondence is metaphoric. So I'm going to make up a bunch of different beads, 20 different beads with positive and negative charges in different places. And each codon on my zipper, each three prongs, is going to represent one of those. Now my messenger RNA goes out to a clam-shaped thing, like looks like a clamshell, called a ribosome. It's not symmetric like a clam. It's got a big side and a small side. And that clamshell is going to open up and chomp down on that messenger RNA and start reading it. Now, meanwhile, the amino acids are each being carried into the ribosome. Whole hordes of them are floating around inside this ribosome, flapping around on little winged creatures called transfer RNA. And I was trying to visualize this morning as I was thinking about telling you this story. And the transfer RNA is going to flap in like a stork carrying a baby. And that stork comes along and it is going to drop just the right amino acid because the transfer RNA reads the knows what codon is being read, and it's going to get called down to drop that bead, the one with two positive charges and a negative, the arginine, onto the chain of amino acids that's being built by the ribosome. And then along comes the next bead, a neutral bead, and then comes a bead with two positive charges. And as the chain gets extruded out of the clam and gets into the cytoplasm, the positive charges on the first bead repel the positive charges on the third bead and spin the head away from the ribosome. And then the negative charge on the far side of the bead is attracted to the positive charges on the third bead, and that's going to snap around and grab that positive charge and negative charge. And now that protein is folded. And as you add beads to this chain, that protein folds in a particular way because of the way it's extruded. And the shape of that protein that's created by the positive and negative charges on the amino acids is what determines the structure of the protein. And the structure is everything. If the structure of my hemoglobin is even one tiny bit off, I have sickle cell disease. And my hemoglobin is going to fold differently. And in certain circumstances, it's going to actually break the protein and break the red blood cell. So it's so important to have the correct protein folding. And when the protein doesn't fold correctly, sometimes it's very hard to destroy and it accumulates. And that's Alzheimer's disease. It's an accumulated protein that's not able to be broken down and sits in the cell and eventually causes its death. And we're going to take our first caller. Give me just a moment. And we're going to Dick in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dick. Hi.
Yeah, you're a great doctor. You were mine years ago. Fixed my nose and a couple other things. But I just wanted to call. I felt that I should call. I figured something out. I had an ablation about a year and a half ago. And it actually was because of I was eating too much bran.
This was an ablation like for atrial fibrillation where they...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. When I fall asleep, my heart would go to about 160, so I had to do something.
Wow.
And I did it to myself. I kind of figured it out. I hadn't talked to my other doctor about this. I thought maybe your form, some other people might be eating too much carbs or too much sugar before they go to bed. In my case, the bran gave me that bad gastral bacteria, I forgot the name of it, in your gut, and put a lot of pressure on my esophagus, which runs right along the the nerve to the heart.
So this would be the Helicobacter pylori? Is that the bad bacteria that in question?
I got checked for that. I didn't have that.
Which was the bad bacteria you had, or you don't remember the name?
Well, when you eat a lot of carbs and sugar, it produces a little more excessive of this gut bacteria that gives you a little bit of gas. And I was having trouble all the way up until the day I stopped eating bran after a meal. I stopped that completely, and I had no more pressure and no more feeling as though I was going to go into AFib. And
that's great. That's great,
yeah.
Dick. And it goes to show that there's a chain of events that isn't obvious, right? This wasn't actually a heart problem. This was a systems problem. Right?
Yeah, it was. It really was. It would. The day I stopped, it was the day the pressure went off, and everything seemed pretty much normal. I am recovering a little bit from the. It seems, you know, a little strange after you have an ablation. They go in there and just kind of burn, you know, around your pulmonary veins there to kill the nerves, so you don't go into AFib. And I just had wished I'd maybe can talk to you before I did that. Anyway.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't, but I think that you shouldn't ever Monday morning quarterback your decisions like that, because you know what you know when you know it and not before, right?
Yeah. But I just wanted to tell people that. I had done a lot of research and to get to that point, and there are an awful lot of people out there talking about digestive problems this type of AFib that I had. So,
well, yeah, because the heart's an electrical entity, and you know when in the old days when our televisions didn't work, back before solid state, we would bang on the side of the television and kind of rattle things around inside, and a lot of times that actually fixed it, because it was a poor connection.
I would have banged for sure.
Uh-huh. Well, you were banging on it. Unfortunately, it was unfixing it in your case, right? The gas was the gas and the reflux were irritating things, and the heart was picking up on some of that irritation.
Yeah, that's exactly. As soon as I stopped the brand regimen, it was like day and night.
Do you mind my asking? Of course, what kind of were these like bran muffins or what were you, what exactly?
No, just a scoop of bran after a meal. I'd been doing it for 10 years,
I could see how that could maybe cause some gas. Okay,
yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you,
and
thank you.
I hope that everything goes well for you and lesson learned. Thank you for sharing it with others.
I love what you're talking about and how detailed you get, and don't stop. It's great for, you know, somebody so knowledgeable as yourself to talk about, you know, especially this anti-aging kind of area that you're kind of, and it's all connected together with, you know, people's general health and getting off prescription drugs. And it's just great that you're on the radio.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope that I will continue to be on the radio for a very long time to come.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. I wanted to talk about a little bit about Parkinson's disease, because we had just a mention of that earlier with the protein accumulation in the brain. And it's a difficult disease because people develop problems with movement and it fluctuates. And at some points in the day, a person can be doing pretty well, at other times pretty difficult, and it's awfully hard to track. People try keeping diaries and stuff, but recently researchers have done some work using body-fixed sensors that I wanted to tell you about. And the body-fixed sensors sit on your back or on your front, and as the people move around through their day, sleep, get up, walk, everything, it kept track of their movement. It could see whether they were shaking. And what was really interesting was after about 3 days, researchers could classify whether or not that person had a high probability of falling or a low probability of falling. And that's something very, very useful. And they were also very interested in looking at, could this have predictive value in monitoring of Parkinson's patients? And I could definitely see asking my patients to wear a Fitbit or one of these other monitors, and not just get, we needed one that was sophisticated enough not just to give us steps, but to also give us maybe the shape of the waveform of that step. And I bet you with a little computer analysis, we'd be able to say that the person's drug schedule need to be changed, because we could see when they were starting to lose their benefit and starting to get shaky, and we might be able to get much, much better management of medications using these sensor devices. So certainly the technology already exists, and I'm totally looking forward to seeing someone develop an app for that, right? Isn't that the expression? And I want to remind you that the numbers to call in are 479-1080. You're listening to Dr. Dawn Motyka, and this is Stepping In. And we're going to step over to the other computer and have a talk with, let's see, John. Hello, John from Santa Cruz.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
I'm 74, and I'm interested in Alzheimer's cholesterol.
Okay. Those are pretty big topics. Do you want to kind of narrow that down for me a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. The brain is what? 70-80% cholesterol?
Well, it's about 70% fat. And a lot of that fat is cholesterol. Actually, the cholesterol is one of the major components of every cell in our bodies. It's kind of what the walls are built of. There are other things, phosphatidyls, choline, this, that, and the other thing, arachidonic acid. Yes, it's all fatty acids.
Now, a question. Statins, I know, work real well getting cholesterol down.
Right, that's true.
But I was always scary about cholesterol, so I use niacin to get my cholesterol down from about 240 down to like 98, 103, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Took a year. Could it possibly be that some of this Alzheimer's and dementia stuff is related to statins and cholesterol?
I'm glad you asked that question, John, because we in functional medicine are very, very worried about that. Let's start with how a statin lowers cholesterol, just because there's a couple factors here. Let me start off actually different and say you probably need to have a cholesterol of at least 110, and I might say 120, a total cholesterol, to be optimally healthy. And that has to do with the fact that you do want a lot of fat in your brain, and you also want hormones. And they call them steroids because they are imitating sterol hormones, and the sterol in the hormone is cholesterol, and that's what we make our estrogen, our testosterone, our cortisol, just lots of hormones are made out of cholesterol, and we need that cholesterol. Even vitamin D is a cholesterol hormone. So you want to have some of the raw material around to make hormones with. Now back to the statins. The way that statins work is they block an enzyme, and it's called HMG-CoA reductase, and it's an enzyme that makes a lot of things. Remember, an enzyme's a folded-up protein. The body usually is just like a tool, maybe a spanner wrench. There might be several things that you would use a spanner wrench for, not just a spanner. Sorry, bad tool joke. But anyway, the point is that you block all of it with a statin, and one of the important things that you make with that HMG-CoA reductase is something called CoQ10 or coenzyme Q10, also known as ubiquinol or ubiquinone, and you see it at the health food stores as a supplement, and it's in every cell of your body, and it's particularly important in your mitochondria, which are your cell's energy factories. So when you drop the CoQ10, you mess with energy generation. And some people can compensate, and many people can't. And you'll find people who every time they go on a statin, they get muscle pain. And there are people who complain that, well, you know, I kind of seem to get a little stupid when I go on a statin. And we think one of our top hypotheses is that it's because in those individuals, they can't compensate for the lower CoQ10. Maybe they're deficient to start with. And I do always recommend, and let me say it right here, if you are on a statin, take some CoQ10. How much? 200, 300 milligrams of a good quality supplement, and just take it every day. Maybe it, belt and suspenders, but my mama taught me to put things back the way I found them. And unfortunately, right. in medicine, we change things willy-nilly with our drugs, and we don't necessarily learn what the what we may have changed without meaning to, the unintended consequence, until it's a little late.
Something about balancing things?
Well, there's balance, and there's also the fact that you don't want to just push buttons when you don't know what they do. And a lot of times we're pushing buttons in places we don't even know there are buttons when we invent a new drug. And we you kind of stand back and wait. And just like what I was saying with the proton pump inhibitors, it took many years for the fact that it increases osteoporosis to show up in the to show up because it took the osteoporosis decades to develop. And so the drug had to be out for decades before we figured out the connection. And with the case of Alzheimer's, and heart failure, statins may be a factor, a bad factor, because of lowering right. CoQ10. And there could be other reasons as well. But ultimately, I'm pleased that you were able to do the niacin. Not a lot. Some people can't tolerate the niacin. And everything else is going well from your health standpoint?
Yeah, I had, as a kid, I thought I was a cowboy, and I've had a number of concussions. And the left side of my brain has been injured. And so not only just memory, but left thinking, intellectual thinking.
Mm-hmm.
My right side, my intuitive thing is taking over quite well. But I quite often will have a problem and then wake up like 3 o'clock in the morning, I have the solution.
Right, I understand what you're saying. It's like the part of you're getting in your way during the day when you're conscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've learned to deal with it, and I'm 74, still run a plumbing business, you know, haul around 50-gallon water heaters and all that stuff.
Dig. Wow, good for you. Go you.
Oh yeah. Well,
okay. Well, do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, what in particular would you suggest for brain regeneration? Because I'm under the understanding that there is this possibility, but something like take vitamins, minerals,
acids.
I take a number of amino acids.
Okay, so let's start with the number one absolute best thing, and you may already be doing it. It sounds like you're pretty active, but for the audience, weightlifting. To the extent that you can manage to push your muscles or that sprint on the bicycle that I'm talking about, because really what we're talking about is force is activity, and whatever you can manage, if all you can manage is walking at 2 miles an hour, well, do 2 miles a day, do what your joints will allow, or go get in a pool and swim, but basically work the muscles, because that creates a hormone in your brain called brain-derived growth factor, and I guess the name says what it does, and that is the best thing. There is no supplement or pill on the planet that's as good as vitamin X, exercise. So you got to do that one, and it sounds like you are, but just, to throw that out for everybody else, from the standpoint... I just said, just to throw it out for everybody else, exercise. Now, a high-fat diet with healthy fat can be beneficial. So we're talking about avocados, coconuts, walnuts, nuts in general are an excellent source of healthy fats. If you're going to talk supplements, fish oil, particularly the fish oil called DHA.
Yeah, I do.
So 1,000 milligrams of DHA a day. There's a couple of other things. Yeah, phosphatidyl serine, phosphatidylcholine. If you those are found in lecithin. They're found in egg yolk, those are really very, very good. There are a number of other. Now we're talking about nerve cell regeneration here as our topic, because you can take ginkgo and increase blood flow to your brain, but that may or may not cause cellular regeneration. But really, that's kind of the recipe that I know about. There's a lot of things out there that are promoted, and there's sort of, you know, a little data or one or two studies, but nothing really, nothing that really hits a home run the way that exercise and the healthy fats do.
How about exercising the brain? I read, maybe 4 to 6 books a week.
Well, you said the problem was cognitive. So I'll tell you this. The science tells us that it's not what you think. So the things that you would expect, like, you know, reading high-level literature in English won't work for you. If you really want to improve your brain, you're going to have to do something hard. So here's two things.
Okay.
Two things for you. Pick one. Learn a different language or learn a new musical instrument. And both of those require you to do a couple of things. One of them is repetition, because you don't do a new instrument and you don't do a new language without lots of repetition. And the other is you have to form new connections. And the act of repetition and forming new connections turns on the genes that form new synapses. And the DNA for that, it starts getting red because you need it for the instrument. But while it's being red, it's going to improve everything else, take it up a notch as well. So the old rising tide lifts all boats. Well, rising levels of brain growth factors lift all synapses. And so that's what the data tells us. For something quick and easy, we don't have it. So, like I said, it's tough and it's a slog. Learn an instrument, learn a language. Those are the two that have the best chance of getting you the results you're looking for on your cognition. Oh, I don't think he liked that answer. Okay, well, the best to you, sir. Okay, this is an anti-aging one that I thought was fascinating. And this was looking at a vitamin called nicotinamide riboside. And nicotinamide riboside, this is the first study looking at this particular nutrient. It has the capacity to turn on that restorative DNA. It boosts metabolism, and that we've known for a while, but this recent research was published in the journal Science back in April, and it looked at this nicotinamide riboside. By the way, this is niacin that our friend, previous caller, was taking. It's a niacin derivative, and it turns on regeneration in stem cells. So as we get older, our stem cells get less effective. They're not able to divide as well. And this is particularly true of our mitochondria, which also don't divide as much as we age. And ordinarily, when there are signals sent by the body, you get regeneration. What happens as we age is that we don't regenerate as well. The researchers were able to give doses of nicotinamide riboside to old mice, 2-year-old mice, and they were able to increase NAD, which is a molecule that's very important in mitochondria. And as they did this, they got a massive improvement in muscle regeneration that was quite phenomenal. They essentially turned back the clock on regeneration for these elderly mice. Now, the dose for humans, if you extrapolate up on a dose per weight basis on this study, to get the increased muscle improvement, and also in these mice, the elderly mice lived longer, so that's a big plus, works out to about 2,000 milligrams. Now, it's certainly possible to take 2,000 milligrams of niacin, although you have to work up to that very carefully. So stay tuned, because there might be a version of niacin out there on the horizon that will really work as a potent anti-aging drug. For right now, I wouldn't recommend taking just plain niacin at that kind of a 2-gram dose. I think the side effects might be a little much. Plus, you're going to throw your B vitamins out of alignment. However, if you're over 50 and you want to hang around for the long haul, taking a multivitamin, making sure you get adequate doses of all the B vitamins. And by the way, if you're a drinker, if you drink at all, particularly if you only eat your vegetables at night and you drink at night, you're going to want to take a B complex like a B50 or a B100 in the morning, because that booze is going to interfere with your ability to absorb your B vitamins. And B vitamin deficiency is just a key to fast-tracking aging. You age faster if you're B vitamin deficient and your energy metabolism isn't good. And by the way, your brain doesn't regenerate as well, and your nerves get sick. We see a lot of nerve regenerative disease. And there's been a ton of research. When people start to get sick with a little bit of cognitive defects, putting them on high dose B vitamins, making sure they get enough B12, making sure they get enough folic acid and niacin and riboflavin and thiamine, makes a difference, a statistical difference, in how fast their brains deteriorate. So I wanted to talk about medical devices, okay? This was a study about FDA approval of medical devices. And one of the things that happened over the last decade or so is that the medical device market has just exploded. And these devices are being approved and then pulled. And so essentially, we're talking about endometrial ablation devices here. These are devices used in a surgery to reduce menstrual flow in women with heavy periods. There also were devices for contraception. And when a team examined 18 high-risk devices, these are things being put up in the body that were approved for use between 2000 and 2015, what they found is that four of them, that's 22%, were approved even though they failed to demonstrate efficacy in clinical trials. And six of these devices, and this is the thing that really steams me, were not required to undergo post-marketing studies. That means once it's released, you have to study to make sure that it's safe and effective and continue to track it. Now, drugs and vaccines get tracked over the long term. And if you have a possible drug side effect, if I think I'm seeing a problem with a new drug, there's a hotline for me to go report that. But we're releasing these devices without really following up on them the way we should be. And the rate of new devices being brought to market is just increasing. And the standard that we have for drugs is decent. To get an approval and then the follow-ups mean that we often pull drugs a year or five after they've been out, because just like I was talking with the caller, the long-term effects of that drug are not possible to be ascertained initially. That's why you don't want to be the first on your block with the new drug unless it's the only thing that's working for you and you've got something serious. But this is not like the new car that nobody else has got. This is something that might have serious unintended consequences. Any of them might. And you just don't know if there's a joker in the deck until, a couple million people have taken it for a decade or so. And then you know. And then sometimes the drug gets pulled because, not only is it not more effective or even less effective, it's more dangerous. So here's something positive about breastfeeding. We've talked a lot on the Dr. Dawn programs in the past, and for my new KSCO listeners, you may not be aware of this, but the microbiome is really important to children's health. And so a study on looking at breast milk found that the bacteria in the infant's gut are influenced strongly not just by the food and the fuel in the breast milk, but I didn't know this, there is insulin and leptin. Leptin is the hunger hormone in breast milk. And so those hormones themselves not just affect the baby, they actually affect the bacteria that are in the infant's intestine. And so the microbes actually respond to the mother's hormone signals. It's just amazing to me that we are actually communicating with the bacteria that a woman's breast milk goes into her baby and talks to the baby's bacteria and programs it for that baby's health. And furthermore, the bacteria that you carry from your mother's breast milk, the bacteria that came in from your mother, are still in your body. You contain, if you were breastfed, strains of bifidobacterium that came to you from your mother's gut and came straight out of her breast and straight into you and are still there. So next time you have a good meal of healthy vegetables and fruits and not a lot of garbage, you can consider that you can just think that as a shout out to your mom. Here, Mom, here's something for you. Anyway, what I want to influence is anything we can do to encourage breastfeeding. And if you're an employer, if you can you make a place for your women to pump, for your employees to pump? Can you create a place, perhaps, that women could go and breastfeed? Just a little room off in a corner somewhere, maybe an office that you're not using. Call it the breastfeeding center. And put a sign up. Maybe there's somebody who's coming into your store or into your business who would appreciate a chance to sit down and feed the baby. And a lot of people have, I personally don't think anyone should have a problem seeing a woman breastfeed in public, but I can imagine being shy, or I can imagine having caught some dirty looks from somebody or some huffiness, you know, how dare you show your breast. So we need to give women a haven. And while we're on the subject, a stressed pregnancy means a stressed baby, and a stressed fetus can turn into a stressed infant. So when you see a pregnant woman out there struggling with whatever she's struggling with, give her a hand. It doesn't really matter if you know her. It's the right thing to do. Not to be gentlemanly or gallant. You want that baby that's inside her to grow up to be healthy, even if you are the most isolated individual in the world who doesn't really care about anybody else. That could be your doctor someday, and if that baby doesn't come out okay, that's going to be some of your tax dollars. So we all have a stake in making sure that every pregnancy is as nurtured as possible. And I think we forget that. And, you know, women really, really, really do the heavy lifting here. And it's extraordinarily important. Barring calls, let's do a deep science dive on the microbiome of the environment. So this is a really interesting thing to consider. But we leave a chemical fingerprint on our environment. The creams and the potions that we use are actually on our body for a long time, and so they kind of become scattered in the immediate environment. It's quite astonishing, this one study that they did where they were doing mass spectrometry, 3D imaging. It's a new technology. So a mass spectrometer basically is a technology that we're looking at as a way to heat up a molecule, ionize it, and measure the mass of the resulting fragments. And it tells you the composition of the starting molecule, how many atoms of carbon, how many atoms of nitrogen. And so it gives you a signature that's a fingerprint. So you can do mass spec now on an environment. You can see that the person sitting at this workstation had coffee on their hands, and that they also used a particular shampoo on their hair that morning because there's traces of that shampoo on their finger, and that molecule, those molecules form a unique fingerprint, the Head and Shoulders fingerprint versus the Herbal Essence fingerprint. You can pick that up in the environment. But this has great potential for being something that we could use in forensics? For example, imagine a CSI where they tell you, all right, we're looking for a criminal who uses Head and Shoulders. His aftershave is Vitalis. He has a cut on his left hand, and he's been using Neosporin for that. And by the way, he's using the unscented downy on his boxer shorts, and he's male. So besides everything else that you know about the criminal, you also can just have evidence based on the body products that he uses. And, of course, this technology can be used for more than than forensics. It can also be used to track people in a military context. It can be used in a research context. And everything we've said about the molecules is also true of the bacteria. So that individual fingerprint that I'm talking about for your skin, for your armpit, for your mouth, for your inner, for the inside of your ear, for your nostrils, you are an ecosystem with a unique bacteria in there. And when those bacteria go off, it can have profound effects on your health. It's exciting science, and we're beginning to learn about it, and it's just an extremely exciting bit of information. I just think that you should join me on the first Saturday of every month here at KSCO at 3 p.m. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.